Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Dr. Craig Packer is a professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior at the University of Minnesota. Over the last 43 years, he's published over 100 scientific articles and become best known for his studies on lions throughout Africa. Last week, we talked about lions and sociality, those forces that drive the big cats together, and how their behavior is reflected in the way they live. We left off with Dr. Packer talking about the Ngorongoro crater and its imperiled lion population. Resolving conflict between lions and the people living nearby is a high priority, and projects are underway to find answers. How do we block lions from killing the people's livestock? And how do we keep the people from killing lions in retaliation? We pick up the conversation with Dr. Packer, who we reached in Santa Fe, New Mexico, via telephone.
So we're trying to set up a project like that in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. It's just started. I have a Swedish colleague, Ingela Jansson, who has been working to get this project started for several years. She is beginning to get more cooperation from the Maasai. And so she has some radio-collared lions that are living between the crater floor and the Serengeti that are in areas where they would be at extreme risk from being speared or poisoned by the Maasai. But she has been working with them so that they can help radio track the lions themselves, tell their friends when a lion is nearby. And so therefore to be extra careful and extra vigilant against a potential lion attack. And so we'll see. There's this idea originated with a study near Amboseli in Kenya in a program called Lion Guardians. Mm-hmm. And the Lion Guardians project was quite reasonably successful. It's been going for 3 or 4 years, and they've been able to reduce the conflict sufficiently that the lions there, the numbers have actually gone up in the last few years. So we'll see if that will work in Ngorongoro as well. If so, the idea is then to kind of restore the connectivity between the crater lions and the Serengeti lions so that new genes could enter the crater floor on its own without us having to dart the animals and bring them in a in a Land Rover. They could come in on their own feet.
Well, quick question about that, actually. Is there any idea of, for example, compensating these Maasai when one of their cattle is killed? I know in India they do things like that, where if a tiger kills local wildlife, they actually do pay the family for the livestock being killed, and that helps with their conservation efforts.
Well, compensation schemes actually seldom work. When wolves were brought back to Yellowstone, part of the deal with the ranchers living in Montana and Wyoming was that they would be compensated for any sheep or cattle that were lost to wolves. But in fact, compensation's tough because you have to realize that a lot of people are going to look at their cow and it's really sick. And if they can manage to convince somebody that that cow got eaten by a wolf or a lion, that's a good deal for them. They then get a free cow to replace that sick one. And so in a lot of situations, there's a very low level of trust. And when people consider the possibility that the livestock holder might not be telling the truth, then the authorities might be too cautious, which leads to resentment, and it's just a bad cycle, you know, because people who really do lose their livestock may not get the compensation that they feel they really should deserve. So what we're trying to do in Ngorongoro actually is an alternative to compensation. Again, the problem with compensation is how do you verify that any single cow or sheep was killed by a lion as opposed to dying in some other way? And that's really difficult. And given, you know, having people to drive out, look for a carcass that may have been lying around for several days, trying to do forensics on it, it's not really worth the hassle.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to do in Ngorongoro, and we'll see if this works, is to follow a system developed in Sweden where there's also a pastoralist group of people, the Sami, who are the reindeer herders. And the Sami live in areas in northern Sweden that still have a lot of lynx and wolverines and all kinds of cool carnivores that everybody thinks should, you know, be conserved. But the wolverines and lynx, they will eat lambs or whatever you call a baby.
Baby reindeer.
And but instead of trying to deal with it one reindeer at a time, they do the following. They go out and they have managers that go out and try to count the number of lynx, the number of wolverines that are living around a particular Sami village. And if the numbers go up, then the Sami get a payment, a performance payment. And so that's been going on for some time. And so the Sami actually get a lump sum. And it's not about any individual reindeer. It's about, well, overall, you get so many kroner or whatever they pay in Sweden for living with these animals. And we've decided this is how much we'll give you. And so it's okay. And so there's a payment. And again, if there's more wolverines and lynx next year, then the payment goes up. So we're trying to set up something like that in Ngorongoro, performance payment scheme. And what we're hoping to do with that is to use a series of camera traps in the Ngorongoro conservation area around some of these Maasai villages and get photographs of whatever goes by. And it's mostly going to be sheep and goats and whatever else, but hopefully the cameras will pick up enough lions that we can say, okay, this village, you guys are living with lions, and so you guys get a payment. And do it every year, and then when the lions go up, hey, your payment goes up. And with that money, we also hope to have some of this lion guardians type work so that the money actually goes towards improving their husbandry. And so in an ideal setting, we would start out with a payment that is based on the overall losses in the area. And so we have a reasonably good guess of how many cows are actually killed. We don't care about any one cow, but it's just the whole sum total of cows. Set the payment according to that so it's enough to replace all the dead cattle, but then also help them to reduce their losses so that in the end, it's actually a net benefit. It's not just canceling out the losses, but it's actually they start to benefit from the presence of lions in their area. So that's the idea anyway, and we'll see. We're just starting, and we hope it might work.
There is, you know, an intersection between tourism and kind of the reality of the lions, and really with any large charismatic predator, that seems to suggest that people are more interested in them than perhaps others, because there is so much mythology, especially around the lion. Is a mythical creature going back to, you know, early civilizations. How would you suggest that people bridge the gap between the myth of the lion and the reality of the lion?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I think people are mostly going to be interested in bridging that gap if they start to think of animals as first the product of an evolutionary process that involves every living thing on Earth. And so they become kind of interested in living things as a biologist would. And then to understand or appreciate, rather, that you get some phenomenally complex patterns that come out of that. And that the lion, to my mind, is an extremely interesting species because they form these groups. Both sexes have their own respective groups, the prides of females, the coalitions of the males. You have conflicts between the males and the females because the males, you know, are infanticidal. They're unreliable in some sense, but once they have their own cubs within the pride, then they're wonderful fathers. And they look after their young, just like any other species. And the grand things that they do pull down very large prey. They do have the capacity to eat us, too. I mean, we get man-eating lions, too. So they are extremely dangerous in certain circumstances. But they are also incredibly sophisticated in their own way. And they're sophisticated in the way that they communicate with each other, the way they decide whether or not to actually participate in a certain activity. And these are things that when you see them, they take your breath away. And I don't know how everybody gets the opportunity to see some of those behaviors, to get that kind of sense of almost magic about them. But, you know, there are films and people write about these things. And so it just comes back, if people are intrigued to delve into some of these complexities, at least from my perspective, then I think they'll find that curiosity amply rewarded. It's very gratifying to see how complex these animals are.
World, you know, obviously we are an organization that deals with the ex situ situation for lions, and have had the privilege of being very close to lions and experiencing what it is to be part of a pride in some ways. And there's language that develops once the basics of survival that are removed that seem rather remarkable and are very similar to some of the descriptions that we oftentimes see in the research field. Do you feel like there is any interface between some of those lessons learned ex situ for research in the natural environment?
Well, let me just say that, first off, not a direct answer yet, but I'll try to get to that. Last summer, I did some research with Kevin Richardson.
Yes.
Who calls himself the Lion Whisperer.
Or at least he's definitely called that by a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah, and I was a little concerned before meeting him that he might be a little bit into, you know, self-promotion at the expense of reality.
Yes.
But I spent a few weeks with him, and I actually really bonded with him because he knows what the lions are doing kind of moment to moment, in a way that's extremely rare. You know, I've worked in the Serengeti for decades, and I've been around a lot of lions, and my students are often amazed because I'll tell them what the lion's going to do next. And, you know, they'll describe a situation, and I say, yeah, and then and I say, oh, yeah, that's what happened. And so, but that's just because of long experience, just patiently watching them and, you know, letting them tell me what they do. And Kevin's that way, too. We were actually doing some research on these lions, and, you know, he and I would sort of, we literally could have scribbled down our answers, and they would have been almost identical for any single thing about what the lions might end up doing, because he knew the animals. He really knew them. So I'm sure that's true with a lot of people who work with captive animals, and especially, you know, if they're in a situation where the animal gets to do other things than just, you know, go in and out of the same door or the cage or whatever, you know, that these animals have personalities and they have their perceptions. And so he really got it. And I had total respect for his perception about the lions from moment to moment. And so I would think that might be quite common. The other thing is that the kind of research we were doing at his facility in South Africa, he was quite welcoming because it was behavioral enrichment. And so giving the lion anything to do that challenges them, either cognitively or reminds them of, you know, maybe their innate responses, he thought that was a good thing for the lions, and that really kept them much healthier and much more fit. And I mean, I should describe some of his experiments. One of them was to see if lions could figure out how to find food by pulling a rope on a box. And then once they've learned how to pull the rope on the box, if you have a box with two ropes and then you have two lions, do they figure out how to do it together? And so just make, you know, getting their dinner a little bit more challenging than just, you know, going to the plate and getting the food. The lions are pretty good at figuring how to pull the rope. A lot of things seem to go wrong with our experiments to see if they would learn to coordinate their rope pulling. But, you know, it's okay. That was still challenging and gave them something to do, like I said. And then we did some other experiments like that where we give them a choice of pots with lids on them. And the food would be in one pot rather than another. And then they had to figure out where the food was. And again, you know, it gave them some things to do. And it worked out, you know, to be quite stimulating for them. And we were actually addressing questions that we could compare the lion's possible intelligence to other species where they've done similar tests to this. So that was kind of fun. But then at the same time, I wanted to see if these captive lions would respond to social triggers in the same way the wild lion would. And by social trigger, I mean like playing the roar of a stranger. And how would they respond to hearing a potential newcomer into their world? And just like with real lions, these captive lions responded. I mean, they were counting how many strangers they were, and it was really cool. And they acted just as switched on as a wild lion. And I've talked to people who've done this to some other species, like hyenas, captive hyenas. If you give them the same kind of tests as wild hyenas, again, they do very well. So that's really the limit of my experience with this. But those kinds of activities do tell us that even though these animals may have been born in captivity and their parents might have been born in captivity, they still retain a lot of what it is that makes them a complex social animal.
Reading some other books, an author, Daniel Quinn, who had written Ishmael, suggested the idea that a culture is essentially a group of people who are acting out a story. And from your experiences, it sounds like a lot of these prides have a mutual interest, a story, so to speak. Do you think that lions have a culture of a sort?
I'm not so sure. Wild chimpanzees have been shown to have culture. And that's because they do a lot of unusual things, like, you know, poke a stick into a termite mound and pull out the warriors and lick them off the stick. Or they take rocks to bang open tough seeds. And you see that in different populations, some animals use the rocks, some chimps use the sticks, but it varies. And the style of using the sticks may be different. So it's really fairly obvious that they have culture. With lions, it seems to me that they're living much more instinctively, much more in reaction to whatever environment there is. And I don't think they retain too much that might be novel by imitating their parents. I think they kind of have to do it again all over themselves. I mean, just for example, in chimpanzees with this termite fishing, mother chimps spend hours some days just poking these sticks into these termite mounds. It's like, you know, it's like going to the casino and working on the you know, the one-armed bandit.
So they could teach the babies how to do it, you're saying? Or,
well, so the babies watch what their mother does, right? Okay, and it's not that she then directs the baby in any way. The baby's just there watching, and it turns out that little girl chimpanzees copy their mother because they're actually paying attention, and they copy their mother. And so if you had grandmother, mother, and daughter, they would probably all use pretty much the same technique. That is, maybe they use a stick that's made out of a certain kind of plant material, and it's a certain length, it's a certain width, and they hold it at a particular part of its width. And so another female might take a shorter one, and then her daughter will also use shorter sticks, and so on. And so it's quite clear how that tradition gets transmitted, because the baby's there and she's watching. But in lions, everything they do just seems so opportunistic, and everything they do seems to depend so much on the topography right here this day, which direction the wind was blowing, who was there, that I don't get a sense that they can see something repeated over and over again so that they then do it themselves. And when I look at lions, when I've traveled around, I mean, I've watched lions in Kenya and Tanzania and many places in South Africa, and they all look pretty much the same to me. And when I read people's descriptions of their behavior, it all sounds pretty similar. I mean, I'm keen to hear some exceptions. I mean, if somebody's got something that sounds unique, I'd love to know what it is, but I haven't heard anything that you'd say, oh, yeah, these lions in such and such a part of Kenya have this tradition of killing their prey, you know, by tearing open the femoral artery rather than choking it to death. You know, I mean, I have never heard anything like that. They all seem to choke them to death in pretty much the same way everywhere. Mm-hmm. They all seem to form prides in the same way. Mm-hmm. Da 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 da. Everything they do seems to be in response to the local ecological conditions rather than something that transcends the immediate circumstances.
You have been studying lions for, like you say, almost 5 decades now. But, you know, from the time that you've started to the present day, there are still a lot of misconceptions, a lot of myths, and a lot of just plain wrong information that oftentimes gets passed along in there. What do you feel is the challenge between trying to get the correct information out to the general public and having that awareness, and why aren't lions looked at more?
Well, I think when I answered a similar question earlier, I said, if people want to think like a biologist, and I guess most members of the public don't want to think like a biologist. And, you know, it's just so convenient to perpetuate the same old stories. And, you know, It has been really surprising. I mean, even among my own colleagues, I often have to correct them, because, I mean, I even got a paper today from a colleague in England who's just written a paper about group territoriality, and yet he leads by saying, oh, it's all about group hunting. And it's like, what are you doing? I mean, he's just relying on his prejudice, you know, rather than anything that he's learned. I think there's something about the way humans like to generalize, and especially they like to endow other species, other groups, with certain romantic notions. And the lion has received so many romantic projections of what we really would like to think nature could be. It's almost like the noble savage, you know. Some people really want to believe that, you know, hunter-gatherer society is just heaven on earth. Well, it's not. I mean, there's, you know, there's murder, there's adultery, there's all kinds of stuff in hunter-gatherer society. And when you get to lions, it's the same thing. I mean, people want there to be out there something that's just much better than ourselves. And in fact, when I wrote my first book, Into Africa, I kind of ended sort of trying to hint at that people really, you know, that humans tend to get really down on their own species. Because, you know, we've all been ripped off. We've all been angry at our own kind. And so we know that humans are flawed and have, you know, feet of clay. But something in us wants to say that out there somewhere, there is a perfect role model. And the lion is just one of those kind of magnets to romanticism, so that people want to believe something really wonderful is going on when lions are doing whatever it is they're doing. And it's very hard to break that. And the most obvious thing, because all that people really want to think about with other species is that, you know, well, they got to eat, right? So they're going to catch something. And we know that they're predators. That's why they're dangerous to us. And that's part of the reason we think about them so long and hard, because they eat. But we don't want to think about lions as having sex. We don't want to think about lions as having war, you know? And yeah, that's not things that are so easily prejudiced in a positive way. Once you allow lions to have sex, it's like, you know, you don't want to believe your parents ever had
right.
sex. You know, your own existence is indisputable evidence that they did have sex. Get over it, okay? But people don't want to think that about anything else. I think it's something from childhood. It's fairy tales, and some fairy tales are really hard to eradicate from consciousness.
So I wanted to ask you a question about kind of the behavior of lions, because I know you wrote an article some time ago called Fear of Darkness, Full Moon, and the Nocturnal Ecology of the African Lion. And
yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, and what was that, what did that show?
Well, I was asked by the Tanzanian government to investigate a really horrible outbreak of man-eating that had started about in about 2002, 2004. And this was really, I mean, historically, I guess if we look back on it now, it was nearly 1,000 people were attacked over a 10 or 15 year period.
Wow, that's a huge number. Yeah.
And so I sent a team of investigators down, and we actually interviewed about 500 survivors or victims' families of these attacks. And we got the details of the circumstances of when that where they were, when it happened, what time of day it happened. And it turned out that there was a very strong effect of the lunar cycle. And it's because lions really rely on their superior night vision on dark nights. But on moonlit nights in Africa, the sky, I mean, it's really bright. And so we can see pretty well too, as can most of the lions prey. So when they're hunting their normal prey, which is wildebeest, buffalo, etc., they're not very good at catching them when the moon's above the horizon. They're much better when the moon is below the horizon. And so I just looked at the timing of all these attacks, and lo and behold, there's a really strong effect of the phase of the moon. It turned out that just the last week before the full moon, there were hardly any attacks. And that's the time of the month when, if you walk around outside after sunset, the moon hasn't set yet. It's up in the sky and it's quite bright. And every night it comes up a little later, so that by the full moon is rising as the sun sets. In the night of the full moon, you can almost read the newspaper out there. It's so bright. But then, right after the full moon, there's an hour before the moon rises. 2 days later, it's almost 2 hours before the moon rises. And so these are the first nights with real darkness when people are out walking around. Because people in Africa are pretty much like us. You don't see huge crowds of pedestrians at 4 a.m.
Right.
You're going to see pedestrians out at 8 or 9 p.m. And so people are out and they're vulnerable in the evening. That's when the lions can grab them. but only when the moon is below the horizon. So the lions have not been very successful in these areas where the only food for them is humans for those last week before the full moon, because it was so bright during the hours when the people were outdoors. But after the full moon, you've got this first hour of darkness, then 2 hours. And so then the lions are in their element. It's dark. They're ready to go. The people can't see them. And the risk of being attacked is about 3.5 times higher in the first few days after the full moon than it was before.
You've been listening to our discussion with Dr. Craig Packer, professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior at the University of Minnesota. Next week, we conclude our discussion with talk about disease outbreaks and its impact on the big cats, as well as what it might take in order for us to have any true conservation of lions in the wild.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.